Welcome to the Beverage Report. Today, we have with us Mr. Sitao Zhu, who is Chief Economist and Partner at Deloitte China, spearheading Deloitte's economic and industry research. Prior to Deloitte, he was Chief Representative of China and EIU Forecasting Director at The Economist Group from 2004 to 2014. Join us as we discuss China's economy, recent policy changes, and its global relations. A special thank you for this episode goes to Annie, Alice O'Donkor, and the LSE Economics Department.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sitao. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Of course. So we'll get started off with the questions. I think one really topical issue right now is protest around the zero COVID policy that have recently ensued. And it seems to have, at least so far, failed to meet the optimism that it would relax the quarantine requirements in the future. We can see that from the recent protests. They've been very rampant in the news. As a result, restrictions have been eased in certain places. So we just wanted to know from you, what do you think the short-term and long-term impacts are of easing these restrictions?
Yeah, I think easing restrictions are very important. Why? This is the third year of COVID. You know, none of us has had prior experience in dealing with this. So countries, just like students, so you are in learning mode. Same, it's difficult to say, you know, which country has done the best. So for example, you look at this country, the UK, I think some of the practice is terrific. Why? I think once you stop testing people, I wouldn't say the problem would go away, but if you stop testing people, you can see, you know, people change their behavior. China is a very different country. Of course, the size, and also many people are not entirely informed, right? So Chinese sometimes they have this herd mentality. Therefore, I can understand in past few years we had this very restrictive policy. And to give China credit, in the early stage of COVID, clearly this policy has prevented, you know, some casualties, I think. But right now we are in a very different situation. For example, in the UK, no one really cares about COVID, right? So whether you have COVID, I have, I don't think it's a big deal. Eventually China would get there, but China as a very gigantic country, they have to do this step by step. So as you said in the beginning, the society as a whole has exhibited some, I would define that as a zero policy fatigue, right? I mean, if you imagine people who have to be making money from service industry, that has been tough. So the government has responded in past 48 hours. I don't want to, you know, bore you with the details. Very concrete target given to the old in terms of vaccination and the way in dealing with close contact and home quarantine, that also being relaxed. So steps by step. But this is very important for the economy.
Yeah. And do you think that in the short term, given that there are still quite high cases of COVID in China, in the short term, could this be harmful?
Well, see, you never know, right? Because we had compared mainland China with Hong Kong. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of students coming from Hong Kong or from large Chinese cities. Large Chinese cities, just like Hong Kong, high population density and also aging population. But the experience so far in Hong Kong clearly suggesting the severe cases were not nearly as many as previously thought. So again, I mean, the official pronouncement in China in past 24 hours is we are in a new era, right? This thing is, you know, transmission is very fast, but it's less deadly.
True. So it seems like it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so.
At
I
least
think so.
For now.
I think so. So I think that's very positive change. Mm-hmm.
So why is it that there's been, you know, so far up until now, there's been a discrepancy in the political ideology around what the best solution is for tackling COVID in China, versus what researchers were suggesting? Because researchers would suggest things like, you know, herd mentality and herd immunity would help right now, given that, like you said, it's less deadly. So why has there been a discrepancy?
Well, again, I mean, I hate to draw the comparison between China and the UK. I mean, you are in the UK. You are in a city with several leading global universities. I mean, this country, UK, has a very strong tradition, you know, medical community. So you see, that's important. It's important because it's important to take expert opinion and to make decision based on science. But again, China is a very big country. We don't have such a tradition, and we are good at doing certain things, and we are less good at doing certain things.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So given that this has taken place right after the re-election of the president of China for the third consecutive term, could this unrest signal a tipping point in, you know, the equilibrium between the government and the people and what kind of relation they have?
The relationship between government and people in China, in past 5,000 years, right? So the officials, again, unlike in the UK, right? So officials, sometimes they want to behave like parents. There is this notion, tough love, but that's not something would work in the UK. But I think people in China, they do expect a government to make certain decisions on their behalf. It's just a very different setting. So very often, the emphasis is on greater goods.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that part has been changed. But the social contract, I think, remains. You need to deliver performance. So what are the key deliverables? I think key deliverables is for China to avoid so-called middle-income trap. So what you see in Latin America, right? And to put in concrete terms, you need to grow this economy, not by 6-7%. Well, you're from India. India can grow by 8%, but really by 4%, I would say on a 5 to 7 year basis. So I think that remains the bargain between citizens and the government.
Wonderful, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think shifting now to growth in China, like you mentioned, I think the real estate sector in China is quite a booming sector, and 67% of the Chinese household wealth is in real estate compared to, for example, 25% in the US. So what incentives for property developers and homeowners created this dominance of the real estate sector in China?
So collectively, we have created this bubble, right? Because most of our wealth tied to real estate. China's capital market has not generated rate of return. I would say quite disappointing in past many years, right? For savers and depositors. So the bulk of our wealth is tied to this. And the sheer size of this sector is very staggering, roughly a quarter of economy. So in past, this sector has been outpacing the general growth of the economy. So just imagine you have a quarter of the pie and making contribution year on year. So going forward is going to be opposite. The quarter of the economy will see subtraction year after year. I mean, that's a very big challenge for us, because it really means we need to find other sectors which can fill the gap left by real estate sector. At the same time, we also need real estate sector to play the role of transition, right? In the near term, we still need this to stabilize growth. So it's not easy, but this is something China has to address.
Mm-hmm. So like you mentioned, there have been some problems in the real estate sector recently, and the growth in it has slowed down quite a bit. What are the reasons behind this, and
Well, I keep this simple, right? So what are the problems? So problems, there are a few problems. One big problem is for many developers, the leverage is already very high. So when interest rates were zero, that's okay, right? But when interest rates are not zero, we're in a global rising interest rate environment, so that presents a problem, number one. Number two, for regional government, their revenue really mainly coming from selling land. So you need to use the proceeds from land auction to pay for civil servants' salaries and all this. So far has been go-go game, but going forward, this won't be the case. And thirdly, we also see demographic changes, right? So China has more than one London, but you have big cities, you have smaller London, but you also have cities experiencing a population reduction, right? So we know that in cities where populations are seeing decline, it's very difficult to sustain the valuation of real estate. So you put all this together, property developers, many of them face some serious challenges. For example, financially, they face challenges in dealing with the creditors. In stock market, underperformance of equities constrain their inability to engage financing, and also the valuation of big Chinese cities just already at a very, very high level.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be very difficult to push that even higher. I think policymakers, they are aware of this, right? So they want to do something. They were acting in a slightly hasty manner. So, but right now they have changed courses.
I see. So before we dive into the solutions a bit, I want to know that given China's strong standing in the global economy,
right,
do you think this might have implications for the global economy?
Yes. China is 70-75% U.S. economy, right? So China is much bigger than other major economies. China is the biggest consumer of global commodities and energy. That is why when people ask me the global implications, what they are asking really, how to define China's demand, right? Because China's demand is not just within its own border. China's demand of crude oil, China's demand of copper, China's demand of iron ore. These are all global implications. And also because China is a very big trading nation, the largest in the world. So if China's demand coming down, then other countries will be seeing the ripple effect. And also because a lot of Chinese neighbors, Southeast Asia, India included, they trade so much with China, so you could have second round effect and a third round effect. And of course, China is also the major creditor to many emerging market, low-income countries. So if China is in retreating mode, so that impact will be also felt by other countries. So that is why people want to look at China's demand through all these angles. My sense is China's property market will go through a rough patch, but I don't think this is going to be a financial crisis. I think China can manage that. China can localize some of this financial distress. Chinese government can implement some, this is Chinese style workout by containing the spillover effect. But one conclusion I think is very clear. This sector won't have high growth going forward. So no matter how you cut and slice it, China needs to find other sectors. So you can have young consumers, you can have energy transition, you can have a new economy, maybe emerging industry. You need to find other areas to fill the gap.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the government and the financial regulators, if they took the right steps, would they be able to regain consumer confidence in the sector, or would they need to completely shift their focus, like you said?
Oh, they need to do both, right? Mm-hmm. They cannot just abandon property sector because, as I said, right, most people's financial stake very much tied to this sector. So my policy recommendation is, first of all, you need to know what's your top priority. Top priority is to prevent a meltdown of the sector. So you need to help these developers, and you need to give them incentive, not just to finish the project. I think you need to give them incentive to actually to do a good job. You cannot just produce, you know, the shoddy apartment. Secondly, you need to convince Chinese consumers this is still the area where your saving will be safe, right? I think thirdly, you also need to maybe lengthen the period of transition so that emerging sectors can grow gradually to offset the adverse impact from this sector. No. By no means you should abandon this sector.
Mm-hmm. I think historically too, China has been known to be able to very well transition into an upcoming sector. Yeah. Well, talking about trade, there's been a recent escalation in the U.S.-China trade war, and the U.S. Department of Commerce enacted export controls on chips to China.
Yeah.
So what is the impact of such barriers to trade, and are there any other areas of tension that this could bring?
This is a big subject, right? So trade dispute can take place between let's say UK and France, or US and Canada. This happens all the time, right? So two allies, right? So just imagine you can quarrel with your best friend, best girlfriend, you can argue with your roommate just on division of labor and all that. That's normal, right? But the trade war started in 2018, I think has moved into a very new chapter, right? Because trade dispute goal was to address trade imbalance. I don't think that's terribly important, but that has not been addressed between China and U.S. stayed the same, despite this very high tariffs. But right now, both sides, they are looking at tensions, rivalries in technology. So this is something very new, because CHIP Act, right? CHIP Act that was being, now it's a law, right? Now it's a law. So it really means U.S. wants to use subsidies and incentives to develop U.S. semiconductor sector to such extent, and China can never catch up. Now, because China and U.S. have a very entrenched economic relationship, so this would affect many companies. This would also affect companies in many other countries. Again, you know, in the UK, there has been a very interesting development involving a UK semiconductor company and being purchased by Chinese company 3 years ago. And the UK government wants to use a national security ground to force the Chinese company to sell a majority stake of this company, right? This semiconductor company based in Welsh. So you can see decision taken by the US would also affect many other countries, right? So it could be Germany, could be Holland, could be South Korea, could be Japan. So this is another level. Now, of course, there will be reactions and counter-reactions from China, export control, and all this. Such escalation would be very negative for the bilateral relationship. The good news was the recent meeting between two leaders at the G20 in Bali, Indonesia. The meeting itself has eased some of the tensions, and the continued dialogue between the two Secretary of State will be in China next week. I think we'll address some of these issues, to use this word from the US administration, guardrail, right? Whether guardrail could be created. So in other words, the two countries will compete, but they need to compete with some sort of parameters, right? So they don't touch each other's red lines. So I hope we have seen the lows of US-China relationship, but of course, I'm under no illusion the relationship will go back to the previous height. So this difficult relationship would continue to evolve.
I see. Well, that's really interesting to know. Yeah. Now, switching gears a bit, I want to talk about another very interesting initiative in China, the Belt and Road Initiative. So firstly, for our audience, could you explain what that is and what was the initial outlook on the initiative?
So maybe you can tell the audience your understanding of Belt and Road. So if you give a definition, what's your definition of Belt and Road?
Well, I understand that China invested in other economies and the financial sectors of those economies in order to strengthen the trade relation between the two economies.
Belt and Road was initiated about 9 years ago. The relationship between China and the West was quite favorable. 9 years ago, China had certain domestic issues. One of them was overcapacity in key sectors, right? So if you have overcapacity, what do? Right? I mean, if you produce too many of certain things, what do? You throw away them or destroy them? In China, it's always difficult to do that because of social impact, right? If you want to consolidate a certain industry, what do is with a dislocation of workers. So I think the idea was if we can envisage the demand could be generated beyond China, then some of these problems would go away. So I think that's one key consideration. The other key consideration was we look at some of these economies. If they are landlocked, Central Asia, can economic potentials be unleashed through connectivity? So, I mean, other considerations, you know, really complementary economic natures between China and Southeast Asia. So you put all this together. So Belt and Road was a launch with a lot of fanfare. After 9 years, I think it's important to just to look at it, right? I mean, in past 9 years, what we have seen? First of all, the relationship between China and the West has become more fraught, right? More fraught. So we have seen a similar initiative of late led by the US to challenge China's and the Belt and Road. Secondly, you look at many of these receiving countries, I would say Africa particularly. I mean, the sustainability of debt you know, really is an issue, right? I mean, even before interest rates were rising, I mean, some of this project, can they be sustained, you know, really? So I think China's approach has been changed in past few years. So the emphasis on transparency, emphasis on governance, I think this is all quite new. So my sense is China's approach going forward will be more focused. So Belt and Road Initiative is undergoing changes. It's becoming more calibrated, right? Not just all over the place, but you know, you go to countries where China has economic synergy, and you go somewhere risk return not being out of whack.
I see.
Yeah.
And so, what do you think the future outlook is going to be for the initiative?
Well, the future outlook will be, as I said, right. You need to emphasize more on economic fundamentals, not just as national security or geopolitical consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think it's important even for China to work with other countries. And for example, right, next year we could have low-income debt crisis coming from Africa. I mean, I can see that, right? So China is one of the creditors, but you also have creditors from the West. This is something new for China, to work with other creditors, so-called the Paris Club, to deal with this debt crisis.
I see, makes sense.
Hmm.
So I'd like to talk about, you know, the climate change problem right now, and we've seen that worsening the climate change as signified by the Henan floods last year have implications for the wider Chinese economy. So in the face of slowing economic growth, how likely is Beijing to keep pace on the target of becoming carbon neutral by 2060?
I think the lesson we have learned is you need to do that with good system. You cannot rely on campaigns and slogans, right? So some mistakes being made, for example, to shut down power supply. I mean, that's just a bad policy, right? So in today's environment can be characterized as the risk of stagflation, meaning lower growth and higher inflation. This is true, not just in China, it's true globally, right? Europe, for example, UK, for example. So naturally, I think as a policymaker, you say, okay, this is an important goal, but is that so important when I'm dealing with rising energy bill, rising electricity bill, right? I mean, so I think all countries have to confront this, right? So I would say in the near term, the pressure will be reduced. But the long-term goal, 2060, this is being said, I think that remains unchanged, because most countries have 2050 or maybe 2055, and China said 2060. I think that goal remains intact, because it's in China's interest to take advantage of energy transition, to take advantage of new industry standard. I also think the pressure, border tax from Europe, right, against steel company, and tax levied against airlines, and all these pressures won't go away. So I would say short term, yes, cyclical pressure, that maybe we just cut off some slack. But in the medium term to long term, no change.
I see. So it's just short term fluctuations that might impact it. So something I found really interesting was that the S&P Global Ratings said in a report that the legacy from the years of high growth led to Chinese companies becoming highly leveraged. So how are companies in China equipped to handle high inflation when other countries and other companies are not able to do it as effectively?
Well, I think Chinese companies, they are more resilient to inflation, good and bad, right? Because if you are good at dealing with inflation, meaning you raise your price to me, then I raise your price to her, right? But if you raise price to me, I cannot pass on higher cost to her. There is a problem because that means I see my profit reduce, right? So for Chinese companies, in general, I think they are very competitive. So they find ways in dealing with higher cost. But when they are at downstream level, meaning very close to consumers, competition can be very, very intense, which means inflation may result in profit squeeze for them because consumers refuse to pay higher prices, because if you raise your price, I buy something from your competitor. So I think for Chinese companies, first of all, I think you still need to become more competitive. This is a big question in today's environment. So when I talk to Chinese companies, very often, and people are very enthusiastic about so-called digital transformation, meaning if labor becoming more expensive, so how do I mitigate such cost? And secondly, I think they want to automate. So that's another very big trend taking place in China's industrial sector. So I think inflation is a very big topic. So nothing easy in China, but they have to find ways in dealing with that.
I see. Well, you shared some very interesting insights with us. I want to know a little bit more about yourself.
Right.
So what have you found to be the most enjoyable aspect in your career, stretching from media groups such as The Economist to being the chief economist of Deloitte?
Right. So Economist Group is a very different media company. It has Economist Magazine. I was not a journalist. But I was heading up EIU in China, Economist Intelligence Unit. So we used to produce country report, you know, customer report, commission report. A lot of these discussions were really being done through interactions. And of course, the style of The Economist, as you know, right? If you assume you read Economist, you know, is very opinionated. So I think that was a very good experience. Deloitte, we defined ourselves as professional service company. So professional service company, just like a law firm, right? So you work for any companies, right? Big companies, small companies, individuals, big public sector, big ministry from the government, or you know, really just you know, companies who are just not known for using economic analysis. But if you think about the essence of the issue, I would say the essence of the issue is about trade-off, right? You constantly weigh benefit and trade-off. I think in many sectors we are working with, you also try to put a price tag, right? So you want to value something. Many years ago, my colleagues in Australia, they have come up with this idea of valuing the best national treasure of Australia, the RIF, you know, right? I mean, they put a price tag on that, So that actually got a major award. So maybe going forward, we can value the Great Wall in China, for example, right? Or, I mean, the idea, I think, is to value things and to present trade-off and choices to your clients. And of course, in our industry, we constantly work with policymakers. So regulatory changes these days are very important. They are driving a lot of changes.
I see. And how do you think your work as an economist differs from someone pursuing academic research?
Oh, that's very different, mm-hmm. right? That's very different. I think I have a lot of respect for people who are doing academic research because you, I have to say in general, your work is more rigorous. The work is more general, right? But in real world, this is not a controlled environment. You deal with human beings very often. Given constraints, you're not having the best policy options. Quite often it's the second best, maybe the third best, right? And today, I mean, geopolitics is such a big issue, local policy issue. Very often, you know, it's not the best policy choice.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any advice for anyone who's willing to pursue a similar career path?
Yeah, I mean, I think I assume you will be in the job market very soon. I would urge you to, you know, work with a company like us, not just us, there are quite a few in the market, and you don't have to go to a big one, you can go to a smaller one. It doesn't mean the bigger the better, right? But the most important thing is to apply what you have learned in the university. It doesn't have to be economics, right? I think these days, consumer taste are very important. How young people think, very important. So you work with the, you know, real issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But finally, something we ask every economist on our podcast, what gives you hope?
I think what's giving me hope is policymakers in past 10 years, they have many mistakes, but they also have learned. And it seems to me, in many incidents, it shows their learning ability. So the learning curve has been very good. For example, in dealing with COVID, again, I would like to use UK as an example, right? I mean, I know people complain. People always complain. But I think the way the UK government is dealing with COVID and is dealing with health issues, I mean, NIH, I think plays a very important role. I think that's giving me a lot of hope.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We had such a wonderful conversation with you, and I'm sure our listeners will love to hear and get a deeper dive into the Chinese economy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.